thank you very much for the welcome, and I feel the material that I'll be presenting tonight, the majority of which has never been published and to my knowledge has never been presented publicly, really belongs or is sort of appropriate to give it for the first time at Quarry Farm. The situation is that Sam Clemens kept a secret diary or journal of the things his children said as they were growing up, and he made many reflections upon his own parenting, and of course upon his wife's parenting of his children. So it's really private material, material that's inside a family. There are times when it's a little sentimental, and I would remind you that James Joyce once defined sentimental as caring more about something than God does. It's very clear to me that Sam Clemens did come to care much more about his family than many people realize. And so one of my long-term projects, and one of the questions for you now, first question, you know, I'm a teacher, I can't help it. First question is, does this material deserve to be published? And then I'll have another question for you a little bit later on. This journal is called A Record of Small Foolishnesses of Susie and Babe Clemens, Infants. And then he began it with a biblical quotation, and Mary treasured these sayings in her heart, which is, of course, I think, making an analogy between his own family and the biblical holy family. And the period of that's covered in this is August 1876 to 1885, which happens to coincide with my own particular special interest, the time when he was working on Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. Some things in this have influence on other books, such as influence on Pudd'nhead Wilson. Like in Pudd'nhead Wilson, at one point, one of the children, one of the infants, says, like it, haunt it, have it, take it, which in other words means if you don't move, as soon as the child says want it, you know, the child is going to take it. And that, of course, comes right out of these journals. It's private and sentimental material, and I have to ask that you not quote or record this except for the archive, because I will be publishing it soon. I've designed an organizational scheme, which is to begin with the youngest child, Jean, who, of course, was relatively... has little time in this journal, so a maximum of 5 years, and then deal with Clara, then deal with Susie, and then deal with the interaction of Clara and Susie. Because you see, the family is constantly changing. One of the things I love or give you two preliminary views, one is that Sam Clemens grew into parenthood. He became probably the best parent that he individually. He was immensely appreciative of her and grew increasingly appreciative of her constant skills, perceptions, her consistency. So you'll be really pulled inside a family. There are times when I'll read some of this material in a child's voice, because of course that's what Sam was trying to capture, is the child's voice. I also have two things that I'll pass around. These are modern versions of stages of child development taken from a daycare center where I happen to have grandchildren developing, and it'll give you a notion of the difficulties that these little creatures have to go through as they learn all this kind of material and as they're growing. Please also realize and remember, and there's two, one for the early stages, one for the second stage. Please realize also that Sam Clemens was trying to figure out behavior before there was much known officially about the interaction of heredity and environment. Mendel hadn't published his material at this point. Mendel was working with peas, which were a lot easier to determine than human beings. And Pavlov hadn't yet done the material about positive reinforcement. But Sam was thinking in these two separate, very complicated areas. I'm going to be going chronologically within each child's development period. And This is organized as a presentation by the child with more emphasis with this system of organization on each child. You see, if I read you the whole journal chronologically, it might be confusing which child is he talking about, how far along are we. But each child had a separate and different and important personality that the family learned to nurture. And of course, you probably know that they lost their first child, Langdon. And I'd like you to also think of the sensitivity and anxiety that a family would have as they're trying to bring along their children before penicillin, before tetracycline, having already lost a child. So it's organized by child, and of course they learned from their children. They learned from Langdon, and they learned from Langdon's death. And they learned from Susie, and they became more relaxed, more confident parents as they went on. But now I'm going to begin with Jean. This begins December 1882. Jean, 2.5 years old now, talks a lot of rock, in German and English, badly mixed. You see, the family had a German nurse, a series of German nurses, and Sam very much respected the German way of bringing up children. She says nothing original or reportable, however. Calls herself Bessie Miss Chain, less of Miss Jane, and Dado Friend, Theodore Crane's friend. She also calls herself Ashew Comfort, Aunt Sue's Comfort. Can you feel the love that's sort of circling in this for a child 2.5 years old? There's considerable music in it to us. And when, as she starts down at 6 p.m., we call out to know who's coming. Who's coming down the stairs? She answers from the unseen remoteness at the head of the stairs. Bessie Miss Chain, coming, Mama. She calls Susie and Clara, Guck and Ben. We have dropped Bay and adopted Ben in consequence. Now, it's terrific to give a child the power of naming another child or naming somebody. It shows a sensitivity. Jean is incomparably sweet and good and entertaining. Sits in my lap at the fag end of dinner and eats Jean Quam, Jean's crumbs, and messes up the table with Jean Shaw, puts Jean Plums in Jean Himble Bowl, Finger Bowl, and says, Naughty George, very naughty George, when George brushes off her salt. Won't consent that she is Mama's blessed Miss Chain. No, she is Papa Bessie Miss Chain. So you can see in this differentiation, attentiveness, a loving acceptance of the child. May 1st, 1883, Sam writes down this good memory. And I can say something later about different standards of discipline. 2 months ago, I took Jean in the nursery bathroom, gave her a lecture about some bad behavior, and then spanked her. The result was disastrous. She went into a passion of furious and vindictive crying, mixed with yells for Rosa, the nurse. Rosa, hey. I whipped her again after vainly trying to get her to say please. Her constant reply was, I won't, Jean won't. I whipped her a third time between spats. Now, spats, I've learned, are sort of loud hits like this that are more designed to be noisy than to be hard or forceful. This will come up later. Jean won't. And then I reiterated gently and kindly, only say please, that is all. Please say please. Then Jean can go to Rosa. She merely continued to howl and call for Rosa and say, I won't. Most fortunately, Mama came and proposed to continue the thing and gave me a rest. I was mighty glad to get out of the dilemma and was resolved not to get into another like it soon. Of course, Mama, with her superior tact, soon got out of Jean all that was wanted. I naturally supposed that my effort had gone for nothing, but not so. A full month later, Rosa heard a mouse gnawing in the nursery one midnight and said, shoo. Jean sat up in her crib and said, better go away, Mousy. Papa come, take you in the bathroom, spat you, and make you say peas. And last night, think she suggested that Rosa had been naughty about something and wanted me to take her in the bathroom and spank her and make her say peas. Summer 1883 at the farm. Poor Jean, now 3 years old, has been neglected in this record, but it is largely her own fault, she having been chary of making reportable speeches. The other day, she asked if she might go and swing herself in the big swing. Mama denied the petition and suggested that Jean was too small. Jean responded, "I can if I could, Mama," meaning I can swing myself if I could get permission. Then a little bit later, I stepped into the nursery. Well, this is in Hartford. I stepped into the nursery on my way to the billiard room after breakfast. I had a newspaper clipping in my hand, just received in the mail, and its spirit was upon me, the spirit of funerals and gloom. Jean sat playing on the floor, the incandescent core of a conflagration of flooding sunlight, and she and her sunny splendors were suggestive of just the opposite spirit. She said, with great interest, "What is it in the little piece of paper you got in your hand, Papa? What do it say?" I said impressively, and meaning to impress her, "It tells about an old, old friend of mine, Jean. Friend way back yonder and years ago when I was young. Very dear friend. And now he's dead, Jean." She uttered an ejaculation and I a response. Then she looked earnestly up from down there and said, "Is he gone up in heaven, Papa?" "Yes," I said, "he's gone up in heaven." A reflective pause, and then she said, "Was he down here on the earth, Papa? Down here?" "Yes, he was down here on the earth where we are." She lowered her face, now grown very grave, and reflected again two or three moments. Then she lifted it quickly to mine and inquired with a burning interest, "And did along come a blackbird and snipped off his nose?" The solemnity of the occasion was gone to the devil in a moment, as far as I was concerned. Though Jean was not aware that she had done anything toward that result, she was asking simply and solely for information and was not intending to be lightsome or frivolous. Then the last, well, a fairly late one for Jean. A heavy wagon went by outside. This is here at the farm. We all questioned what the noise might be. Jean said, "I hear it thunder," and that's Elsa, the German nurse. By that time, we had a different German nurse. Two others about Jean. Sam's talking to Susie. Susie complains, "I think it's pitiful, Mommy's faith in Jean's ability to keep a secret." At breakfast, this had come up. The mama then discussed it and brought it under criticism. Mama's sick upstairs, abed. I carried it straight up and told her this was a great fuss about it. Jean keeps part of a secret, but always lets the other part out, the important part. Last entry for Jean, June 7th, 1885. Jean says, "I wonder God lets us have so many ducks. Patrick kills them so." Because, of course, up here at the farm, they were basically running in a farm that they would eat from. Jean seems to me to be a fully loved child. When I think of the duration of the span of her life, it's of course a story with a great deal of sadness in it, because of the treatments that she needed. She was a gentle person, she loved animals, and she passed away December 24th, 1909, and Sam could not bring himself to leave the funeral. Now we shift to Clara. Different personality. He writes at the very beginning about Clara, very beginning of the journal, in 1875, in the journal, 1876. Clara Clemens, commonly called the Bay at this date, was born at Quarry Farm in the Elmira Hills, 8th of June, 1874, and is 2 years and 2 months old at this writing. She was named for Miss Clara Spaulding of Elmira, a very special friend of the parents. When she was an hour and 4 minutes old, she was shown to Susie. She looked like a velvet-headed grubworm squirming in a blanket. And no matter, Susie admired. She said in her imperfect way, "That Bay got boofful hair." So Clara has commonly been called Bay to this day, but will take up her right name in time. So here again, it's the power given to a child to name, to observe. When the bay was a week old, her adventures began. Now this shows you the frankness and the honesty that Sam has toward his own role. When the bay was a week old, her adventures began. She was asleep on a pillow in a rocking chair in the parlor at Quarry Farm. I'd forgotten her presence if I knew it. I wound up a mechanical toy wagon and set it loose on the floor. I saw it was going to collide with the rocking chair, so I kicked the rocking chair across the house. The bay lit on the floor with a thump. Her head within 2 inches of the iron fender of the grate, but with the pillow undermost. So she came within 3 inches of an obituary. You can feel the guilt, but also the honesty about this. The bay learned to walk early enough, but now at 2 years and 2 months, she cannot say 10 words, but understands the entire language. We happen to have several grandchildren who've walked through this phase. About a fortnight ago, Bay got what may be called her first thrashing. Her mother took both children gravely to the bedchamber to punish them. It was all new to Bay, and the novelty of it charmed her. Madam turned Susie across her lap and began to spat her very lightly. Bay was delighted with the episode. You know what's coming. Then she was called for and came skipping forward with jovial alacrity and threw herself across her mother's lap as who would say, "My, ain't these good times?" The spat descended sharply, and by the war whoop that followed, one perceived that Bay's ideas about these festivities had changed. The madam could not whip her for laughing and had to leave the punishment only half finished, only half performed. Then a little bit later, in May of 77, a month or more ago, the bay was naughty in the nursery and did not finish her dinner. In the evening, she was hungry, and her mama gave her a cracker. I quote now from a letter written to me by mama when I was in Baltimore 2 or 3 days ago. Now think of positive reinforcement, negative reinforcement, all the things. You know, what should you do when your child does something wrong? Should you reward the child? Now this is Sam quoting Libby. Last night, after George had wiped off her sticky fingers in the china closet, Bay came out with her little sad, downcast look and said, "I've been a little naughty upstairs. Can I have a cracker?" She's converted being naughty into what you have to do in order to get a cracker. A slight thing within our family, one of our children's families have a habit of rewarding the dog when the dog comes back in from going outside with the cracker. So, of course, the dog is always wanting the cracker. And so, one time I made the mistake of saying, "Who has become trained?" Impolite to say that, okay. The child's confused with cause and effect. In Geneva, in Filthy Party, Bay, 2 years and 2 months old, she can say only a few words and is very fond of rocking and singing to no tune. Now this child, you'll see, has a little more willfulness, a little more independence, a little more sort of solidness or stolidness of personality. She sings De Papa, De Mama, De Dua, Theodore Crane, De Tante, Tante, German for Aunt Sue, and Yoa is Rosa, She is sister. It's customary to say, "Now, babe, sing the Holy Family." Whereupon she performs as the above. Then we say, "Now, babe, let's have the catechism." Now, notice, too, that conventional religion isn't sacrosanct, put off in a separate category, but it's right there in the family, but with new people to identify. "Now, babe, let's have the catechism. Who is a hard lot?" "Ah, who's a particularly hard lot?" "Dua. Who's the hardest lot in Chemung County?" "Tante, Aunt Sue." "Who's the hardest lot in America?" "Yoa." Which is the nurse. "Who's the hardest lot in the civilized world?" "Mama." "Who's the confoundedest, hardest lot in the entire universe?" "Me." Can you see the independence and so on that this is fostering for? Turned over one or two pages. In Geneva in September one morning, I lay abed late as Bay was passing through the room and I took her on my bed a moment. Then she went to Clara Spaulding and said, "Aunt Clara, Papa's a good deal of trouble to me lately." "Is he? Why?" "Well, He wants me to get into bed with him, and I can't do that with Jemuls. J-E-L-M-U-L-S. Gentlemen. I don't like Jemuls anyway. What? You don't like gentlemen? Don't you like Uncle Theodore? Crane. Oh, yes, but he ain't a Jemul. He's a friend. Can you see the wonderful combinations of categories that the child is putting together? Tonight she was trying to remind her mother of something and said, it was in Rome. No, Florence. No, I think it was Venice or Baden-Baden. Then after a pause, now I know it was where we saw that kitty. Moralizing the fact that she has noticed nothing but kitties in all of her European travels. So this is what happens if you take a child abroad and travel a little bit too young. This morning, when Bay discovered that this is my birthday, November 30th, 1878, she was greatly troubled because she provided no gift for me, repeated her sorrow several times. Finally, she went off musing to the nursery and presently returned with her newest and chiefest treasure, a large toy horse, and said, you shall have this horse for your birthday, Papa. I accepted it with many thanks. After an hour, she was racing up and down the room with the horse when Susie said, my parrot, you gave that horse to Papa, and now you've taken it back again. And the baby says, I never give it to him for always. I give it to him for his birthday. See how the children structure time and everything? It's delightful. Bay finished her little first German reader yesterday and came in with a triumphant announcement. I'm through, Papa. I can read any German book that ever was now. Susie announced today that she was also through now and could read any German book. And if I can read any German books, I can read German papers too, can't I? She had the Allgemeine Zeitung in her hand, ready to begin. I was obliged to dash her spirits by saying I didn't believe anybody could read a German newspaper. However, if the children are a trifle mistaken as to their ability to read German, they certainly speak it as well as they do English, and glibly and prettily. Here's another memory. Once, when Bay was 3 or 4 years old, she said, Mama, I brung you these flowers. Paused, then corrected herself. Mama, I brang you these flowers. Paused, then corrected herself. No, I brung them. So the child really tries to say the things in the correct way and has, of course, so much trouble with verb tenses in this highly irregular language. Now we move... Still one more, or still a few more for Clara. But the other day, when Susie's tooth was pulled, Bay overheard some of the praises for her fortitude and consequently has been aching to have a tooth pulled herself ever since. She's been trying daily, but without success, to convince us all that one of her teeth is loose. But yesterday, when Susie developed 2 decidedly loose teeth, Bay gave it all up in despondency and despair. It was no use to buck against such odds as that. Which reminds me that when Bay was 3 years old, Susie was taken down to town one day and taken with the vomiting when she got back in the evening. Bay, off in the corner in her crib, totally neglected, observed the coddling and attention Susie was receiving, as long as she could reasonably stand it. Then she sat up and said gravely and simply, well, sometime I be dressed up and go downtown and come back and throw up too. The imitative desire, only partial knowledge of the consequences. For some months, Bay has been bribed not to quarrel with Susie at 3 cents a day. I'll just tell you briefly. Bay tried everything. Bribery, candy, money, spanking. She's been bribed not to quarrel with Susie at 3 cents a day. Conversation today. Bay. Mama, you owe me for 2 days. Mama. Bay, you've not seen Susie for 2 days. She's been sick in bed. Why, Mama, don't you count that? About the 18th or 20th of October, 1880, Bay, who has never been allowed to meddle with English alphabets or books, lest she would neglect her German, collared an English juvenile poem book sent to her from London by Joseph the Courier. And now, 10 or 12 days later, October 30th, She reads abstruse English works with an astounding facility. Nobody has given her an instant's assistance. Susie has learned to read English during these same 10 or 12 days, but she's 8 years old, and besides, she can't read it as glibly as they can. Clara picked up a book. This is 1883. Now think of this in terms of Huckleberry Finn, the veneration for books, romance, and so on, that was part of Twain's lifetime. June 8, 1883. Clara picked up a book, Daniel Boone, by John S.C. Abbott, and found on the flyleaf a comment of mine, puzzled over it, couldn't quite make it out. Her mother took it and read it to her as follows: a poor, slovenly book, a mess of sappy drivel and bad grammar. Clara said with entire seriousness, not comprehending the meaning, but charmed with the sound of the words, "Oh, that must be lovely." She carried the book away and buried herself in it. So see, some of this is not really understanding the words, but wanting to be a grown-up and wanting to participate in it. Clara, of course, gets a little less attention, and I think one of the sadnesses in my interpretation of her life is that she tried in her life to recreate the same loving atmosphere that she had as a child. I think she was mistaken in her judgment of the second husband. My own personal opinion, but I can see a certain amount of pathos in Clara trying to reconstruct that very, very loving atmosphere. With me so far? Okay. Now I'd like to begin with the oldest, Susie. They were, please remember, when Susie was born, less experienced parents. And they were soon to have the trauma of Langdon's passing. Susie's 4 years and 5 months old when the journal begins, but Sam sort of sets it off as the beginning of a biography. Olivia Susan Clemens was born at the Langdon Homestead in Elmira, New York, 19th of March, 1872, and was named for her grandmother and her aunt, Susan Crane. From early babyhood until she was 3.5 years old, she was addicted to sudden and raging tempests of passion. Coaxing was tried, reasoning was tried, diversion was tried, even bribery. Also deprivations of various kinds. Also captivity in a corner. In fact, everything was tried that has ever been tried with any child, but all to no purpose. Those of you who are experienced parents may have some notion of kind of willfulness that you can come across sometimes. Indeed, the storms grew more frequent. At last, we dropped every feature of the system utterly and resorted to flogging. But from other material, I believe that means stats, not flogging in the taken 20, well, you say like 2 years before the mass or anything like that, for all the time. We had to whip her once a day at first, then 3 times a week, then twice, then once a week, then twice a month. She's nearly 4.5 years old now, and I've only touched her once in the last 3 months. Spare the rod and spoil the child was well said, but not by an amateur, I judge. Susie never had but one nickname, a mistake, see below, but only kept that one a year. That was Modoc from the cut of her hair, because they cut her in sort of an Indian style of haircut. Susie began to talk a little when she was a year old. If an article pleased her, she said, like it, want it, have it, take it, and took it, unless somebody got in ahead and prevented it. Of course, those of you who spent time with Pudd'nhead Wilson know that whole sequence. I'm going to skip over material that was used in the autobiography or that was used in the magazine article that's around here. Please take one of those magazine articles about Sam Clemens' parent. There's other good articles, well, there's other articles that I hope will interest you also. Susie began to talk at 1 year and began to walk in London and perfected herself at 18 months in Edinburgh. The other evening when we were at dinner, the children came down from the nursery as usual to spend the hour between 6 and 7. They were in the library and the folding doors were open. Presently, I heard Susie tell the babe to lie down on the rug before the fire, which they did. Then Susie came into the dining room, turned, ran back, hovered over babe and said, "Now, babe, you a little dead baby, you know, and I'm an angel come down to take you up to heaven." come now. Get up, give me your hand. Now we'll run. That's to pretend to be flying, you know. Ready now. Now we're flying. And they came flying by the dinner table. Something there attracted the bay's attention, and she suddenly stopped. But Susie ran on, full of enthusiasm. She brought up behind a chair by the door and cried out, "Come on, babe, here's heaven," and put her hand on the doorknob and said, "See, here's Jesus." If you've lost Langdon, can you keep your eyes dry when that happens? I think that would tear most people. Susie, being ordered to bed, said thoughtfully, this was at the farm right here. Susie, being ordered to bed, said, and she's 5 years old, "I wish I could stay up all night, as God does." Never thought of that. Susie has been a little unreliable in stating facts. I've reproved her quite sharply for it. She went and sat down by herself for something and then said, "Well, Mama, I don't know what to do about it, except that I'm sorry and won't do it again." Pretty decent. Susie tried to work on a Bristol board and failed somewhat and said, "Well, Mama, you know the world was not made in a day." Susie, 4 and a half, perceived that her shoes were damaging her feet from being too small. I got her a very ample pair of the most villainous shape and style. She made no complaint when they were put on her, but looked injured and degraded. At night, when she knelt at her mother's knee to say her prayers, the former gave her the usual admonition, "Now, Susie, think about God." "Mama, I can't with these shoes." Several times, Livy said to Susie, "There, there, child, you must not cry for little things." One day, when there was nothing under discussion, Susie came up out of a brown study with the formidable question, "Mama, what is little things?" No man can answer that question, nor no woman, for nothing that grieves us can be called little. A child's loss of a doll and a king's loss of a crown are events of the same size. Livy could not furnish a sufficient answer, but Susie did not give the matter up. She worked at the problem several days. One day, when Livy was about to drive downtown, one of her errands being the purchase of a long-promised toy watch for Susie, the child said, "If you forgot the watch, Mama, would that be a little thing?"
Yeah.
Yet she was not concerned about the watch, for she knew perfectly well it would not be forgotten. What the struggling mind was after was getting a satisfying grip on that question. Repeatedly, 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 "You will find, we will find," that Livy was utterly consistent. And that was so important for the positive growth of these children. One time, here's a few other things Susie says. "Mama, do we walk ourselves, or is it our bodies that are alive?" Another time, she said, "I find, Mama, that there are a great many things that I don't understand." She was talking about rain and water, and when water changes to rain, the water. October 1876, age 4 and upwards. Susie's mother read to her the story of Joseph. The killing of the kid, the baby goat, to stain the garment with blood, was arrived at in due course and made deep impression. Susie's comment, full of sympathy and compassion, was, "Poor little kid." This is probably the only time in 4,000 years that any human being has pitied that animal. Everybody's been taken too much up with pitying Joseph to remember that innocent little animal suffered even more violently than he, and is fairly entitled to a word of compassion. I do not suppose that an unhackneyed, let alone an original thought, could be started about an old Bible subject, but plainly, this is one. Imagine sort of reading through the Bible from the animal's point of view. Find it a very different book, I suspect. Age 4 and a half. Susie repeated a little German stanza about the Vogler, and I read it from the book with deliberation and emphasis to correct her pronunciation, whereupon the bay, in shattered English, corrected me. I said I had read it right and asked Susie if I hadn't. She said, yes, Papa, you did, but you read it so distinctly that you fused brains. You read it so distinctly that you confused the chuckles. That's pretty darn smart for a 4.5-year-old. Susie has always had a good deal of womanly dignity. One day, Libby and Mrs. Lily Warner were talking earnestly in the library. Susie interrupted them several times. This, I'm pretty sure, is a hard one. Finally, Libby said very sharply, Susie, if you interrupt again, I will send you instantly to the nursery. 5 minutes later, Libby saw Mrs. Warner to the front door. On her way back, she saw Susie on the stairs and said, where are you going, Susie? To the nursery, Mama. Why are you going up there for, dear? Don't you want to stay with me in the library? You didn't speak to me right, Mama. Libby was surprised. She'd forgotten that rebuke. She pushed her inquiries further. Susie said with gentle dignity that carried its own reproach, you didn't speak to me right, Mama. She'd been humiliated in the presence of an outsider. Libby felt condemned. She carried Susie to the library and argued the case with her. Susie hadn't a fault to find with the justice of the rebuke, but she held out steadily against the manner of it, saying gently once or twice, but you didn't speak to me right, Mama. She won her cause, and her mother had to confess that she hadn't spoken to her right. We require courteous speech from the children at all times and in all circumstances. We owe them the same courtesy in return, and when we fail of it, we deserve correction. See how hard it is to hear people discipline their children in a supermarket nowadays or something like that. Susie made a philosophical remark one day in Paris when she was in one of her reflective moods, the wording of which I cannot recall, but the exact sense of it was that the proverb, it is the unexpected which happens. One day, Libby and Clara Spaulding were exclaiming over the odd, queer ways of the French. Susie looked up from her work of doll dressing and said, well, Mama, don't you reckon we seem queer to them? The ability to change point of view, that's just phenomenal. One day on shipboard, a group of ladies and gentlemen began to question Susie as to her relationships. One lady, who felt herself on the track of a kinship with Libby's mother, asked Susie what her grandmama's name was before she was married, which brought out this grave slander, uttered with tranquil simplicity. My grandmama has never been married. Susie, she's growing steadily into an admirably discriminating habit of language. Yes, and into the use of pretty large words, too. Sometimes, as witnessed the night before, I referred to some preference expressed by Jean. Susie wanted at once to know how she expressed it, inasmuch as Jean only knows about a dozen words. I said, why, she spoke up with marked disparity and exclaimed, well, Mr. Clemens, you may support that fallacy if native perversity and fatuous imagination so move you, but the exact opposite is my distinct and decided preference. Susie's grave eyes stood wide open during this speech. She was silent a moment to let it soak home, then said in a tone of absolute conviction, well, Papa, that is an exaggeration. One evening, now here's two on praying. One evening, Susie had prayed. Babe was curled up for sleep. She was reminded that it was her turn to pray now. She said, oh, one's enough. Dropped off to slumber. Once in Paris, we found out that Susie had about ceased from praying. The matter was inquired into. She answered with simplicity, I hardly ever pray now. When I want anything, I just leave it to him. He understands. The words, without her voice and manner, do not convey her meaning. What she meant was that she had thought the thing all out and arrived at the conclusion that there was no obstructing vagueness or confusion between herself and God, requiring her to explain herself in set words. When she felt a want, he knew it without its being formulated. and could be trusted to grant or wisely withhold as should be best for both parties. And she was conscious of the impropriety and the needlessness of bothering him with every little craving that came into her head. Can you see the security that that child grew up with? Amazing security. And also, I would say, some sense of importance for things, too. She's not going to be praying for a little tiny thing. Susie is singularly thoughtful. She often makes me blush for my distinguished lack of that quality. Many a time I've proposed to her some dazzling enterprise which I expected her to jump at with delight and have been shot down with the remark, "But Papa, you know Mama does not allow us to do that." Perfectly true, but I've forgotten it for the moment. She and baby will have every right to remember their mother with pride and speak of her with affection and reverence as long as they live. For their shuttlecock of, that's like a bad angel, a capricious fool in petticoats who is all sugar one moment and all aquafortis the next, who thrashes for a misdemeanor one day which she will allow to pass tomorrow, who acquires obedience by fits and starts and puts up with the opposite in between. No, this description, which fits more or less closely the vast majority of mothers, does not fit theirs in any part. Their mother has always kept faith with them. They could always depend upon her. They could never doubt her. When she promised them a punishment or a present, they knew it was just as sure to come as if the angel of faith had spoken. They knew that all her promises were as good as gold, for she never told them a lie, nor ever beguiled them with a subterfuge. They also knew that she never punished in revenge, but in love. And the infliction wrung her mother heart and was a sore task to her. Let them bless her more for these punishments whilst they live than for her gifts, for she was born to give. Can we feel the love of Sam for living in this, and the judgment and the respect? He's grown a long way from Hannibal by the time we've come to this, because I think the influence of the Langdon family upon him was just enormous. Let them bless her more for these punishments whilst they live than for her gifts, for she was born to give, and it cost her no pang. But to deal out penalties was against her nature, but she did deal them out firmly and unflinchingly for the great love she bore her children. Mothers have all sorts of formulas. Do that or I will punish you. If you do that again, I will punish you. If you will do so-and-so, I will give you something nice by and by, and so on. And still the child disobeys persistently, and nothing comes of it. For the child has learned that the promises of punishment will not be kept, and that the promised nice thing will be given anyway, for the sake of peace. Libby's formula was simple. Do this. And it had to be done. It was kindly and gently spoken, but it admitted of no deflection from the exact performance. She is a perfect mother if ever there was one. One day, a neighbor of ours, a neighbor of ours, whose children never obeyed her except when it suits them, begged Susie and Babe to come in and see her. They were in her ground. They declined and said Mama had told them at some time or another not to go into a house without her permission, thus intimating their knowledge that although the command had not lately been repeated, it was still in force and must be respected until it was distinctly abrogated. This ought to have compelled this lady's admiration. On the contrary, she heedlessly set herself to work to persuade the children to come in against their consciences, saying she would take all the responsibility, etc. Of course, these are the days long before the reveal of the child, long before the same publicity for child abuse. Still very good judgment not to have the children go to someone else's house. At last, she won their reluctant acquiescence. She took all this trouble to undermine a foundation of obedience which had been laid at such protracted and painstaking cost. I never can think of this outrage and keep my temper. So you hear about Sam's volatile personality and so on. But imagine being this angry about somebody contradicting the wife's order to the children. However, at the end of 2 minutes, she found that the children were so full of doubts and misgivings and so ill at ease that they were far from enjoying themselves, and so she let them go. This lady is one of the noblest and loveliest spirits in the land, but she is no more fitted to govern children than she is to govern the Indians. Now, here's something about Sam's storytelling. In Paris, when my day's writing on the sixth floor was done, I used to slip quietly into our parlor on the second floor, hoping to rest and have a smoke on the sofa before dinner was brought up. But I seldom succeeded because the nursery door opened onto the parlor, and the children were pretty sure to come in for something and discover me. Then I would have to take the big chair, place a child on each arm of it, and spin them a story. Whenever Bay discovered me, she always called out, without any preliminary bye-bye, "Susie, come, gonna have a story." Without any remark to me, she would go and get a magazine, perch herself on the chair arm, seek out a picture. He calls it a suggestive picture, but it means a picture that can be used for the imagination. Not what the modern media suggested. Seek out a suggestive picture, Susie taking perch on the other arm meantime, then say, "We're ready, Papa." The tough part of it was that every detail of the story had to be brand new, invented on the spot, and it must fit the picture. They wouldn't have the story that already belonged to the picture, nor any part of it, nor any idea that was in it. They were quick to discover when I was borrowing a suggestion from the book, and then they would immediately shut down on that irregularity. Sometimes they would take such a strong fancy to one particular picture that I would have to build an entirely new story upon that picture several evenings in succession. Can you imagine the fiction making and so on that this has to do? Their selections were pretty odd, too, sometimes. For instance, in the back part of a Scribner's Monthly, they once found an outline picture which Page the artist had drawn to show the just proportions of the human figure. He drawn a picture about, like, man is the measure of the world type of picture. The chances of getting anything romantic, adventurous, and heroic out of so sterile a text as that seemed so remote that I tried to divert them to a more promising picture, but no, none but this would answer. So I bent myself to my task and made such a thrilling and rattling success of it that I was rewarded with the privilege of digging a brand new story out of that barren picture during the next 5 evening sessions. I wore that poor outline devil's romantic possibilities entirely before I got done with them. I drowned him, I hanged him, I pitted him against giants and genies. I adventured him all through fairyland. I made him the sort of fairy dragons of the air and the pitiless monsters of the field and flood. I fed him to the cannibal. The crossbars which intersected him were the iron gratings of a dungeon in our story, the web of a gigantic spider, parallels of latitude and meridians of longitude, webbing a vast and helpless denizen of the wandering commons, and so on. For it was rigidly required of me that these crossbars be made to play a big and essential role in every yarn. In all my inventions for the children, from that day to this, I've always had one formidable difficulty to contend with. Any villains must not lie. This hampered me a good deal. The blacker and bloodier and viler I painted the villain in my tale, the more the children delighted in him, until he made the mistake of telling a lie. Then down he went, in their estimation. Nothing could resurrect him again. He simply had to pack up and go. His character was damaged beyond help. The children couldn't have him around any longer. Sometimes I tried to cover up or slide over or explain away one of these lies which I had blundered into. But this was lost time, for Susie was an alert critic. I calmly proceeded one evening. But the moment the giant invited him, the grasshopper whispered in Johnny's ear that food was poised. So Johnny said very politely, "I'm very much obliged to you indeed, sir, but I am not hungry." "Why, Papa, he told a lie." Without that blunder, I said to myself, I must try to get Johnny out of this scrape. "Well, you see, Susie, I reckon he didn't think what he was saying. But, Papa, it couldn't be, because he just said that very minute that he was so hungry." "Yes, that's true. Yes, that is so. Well, I think perhaps he was heedless. he just came out with the first thing that happened to his mind is, oh no, Papa, he was never a heedless boy. It wasn't like him to be heedless. You know how wise he always was? Why, night before last, you remember, this was a repeated story, which lasted over a week, when all those fairies and enchanted creatures tried their very best a whole day to catch him in some little carelessness so they could get power over him. They never could, no. Now see, this is also something about inculcating truthfulness, independence, integrity, and adventurous circumstances. And from his point of view, it's being amazingly inventive on sort of relatively easy things, but with strict parameters that can't be violated by and that will be noticed. This is almost like being a cousin of being a good proofreader. Sam could read his own fiction and find inconsistencies and find things to sort of snap it. It was probably easier for him to do it in his own fiction than with his children. Susie, I reckon he was so weary and kind of tired out. My Papa, he rode all the way on the eagle and he'd been sound asleep the whole day in the golden ivory bed with his two lions watching him and taking care of him. How could he be tired, Papa, and be so strong? You know, the other night when his whale took him to Africa, he got one ashore and walked all day and night. He wasn't a bit tired. You know, the other time one, yes, you're right, Susie, I was wrong. He couldn't have been tired. But I never intended to be wrong. I'm sure he didn't mean it when he said it. But it was a lie, Papa, if he didn't mean what he said. Johnny's days of usefulness were over. He was up a stump and I had to leave him there. The children are good listeners, generally. They do not interrupt or criticize until somebody lies. Then the interruptions come thick and fast. They will put up with all inconsistencies in my people cheerfully, but that solitary one. Then even the blackest scoundrel should lie is out of character, inconsistent, inexcusable, and the children are bound to call it to the strictest account every time. They did not get this prejudice from me. He sure has his own abilities at this. Now, in the later portions of it, Sam pays much more attention to the interaction, similarities, and contrast of Clara and Susie's personality. So now I have to ask you to kind of keep the two personalities in mind. Because this was a puzzle to them. Parenthetically, I can remember the day when I realized that our new baby was different in personality than his two-year, one-month-old brother. It was somewhat like a big surprise to me that they didn't react exactly the same. Sam's going through that same kind of exploration. Faye is a sturdy little creature, very practical, precious little sentiment, no nonsense. She's sensitive and can be deeply hurt. But I think she must have been 5 years old, she's six now, before we discovered this fact. Like a lot of second children, basically, she has kind of a rough, ready aspect to her. She falls down, nobody makes a fuss, she just gets up and keeps on going. This, I think, was because she has the power of concealing all but the big hurts, a power born of her high pluck and fortitude. Pluck and fortitude have been marked features of her character from the very beginning. They were born in her, but they had to be educated into Susie, who has them now, 8 and 1/3 years old, in a pretty considerable degree, but was born destitute. When Bay used to toddle out to feed the fowls, they would swarm around and all over her greedy, struggling horde and trip her up and buffet her down occasionally, all of which she enjoyed. I don't know if you've ever seen a child in a bunch of geese or ducks or something like that. Something to see. But Susie used to fly. Bay did not mind the electric shocks from the bell buttons on cold mornings, but they frightened Susie. Bay, at 3, could hold Japanese fireworks in her fingers till they flashed and spit and sputtered all away. But when the angry volume of sparks began to storm around Susie's hand, she would presently back down and let go. The children's hands are always full of slivers. It was distressing and exasperating to observe Susie's poltroonery under the operation of removing them, but it was mere entertainment to Bay to have her slivers dug out. When Bay was 3, she had the end of her forefinger crushed nearly off. She was full of interest and comment when the doctor took his stitches and hardly winced. In Europe, Susie was shy of crowds of strangers and hung back in the shelter of the party, whenever we arrived at a new town, and it's being in, that they always marched far in the lead and alone, and tramped up the steps and invaded those hotels with the air of a proprietor taking possession. May is not without a certain degree of pride in her fortitude. Last spring, she had an angry and painful boil in her hand, and Mama made preparations to cut into it. May was serene. Susie was full of tremors and anxiety. As the cruel work progressed, May was good grit and only winced from time to time. Susie kept saying, "Isn't she great?" And at last the compliment was even wrung from Mama, who said, "Why, you are a brave little thing." May placidly responded, "There ain't nobody braver but God." The self-comparison, and also the closeness of the self-comparison. That's something that Richard doesn't feel distant and subordinate to God. That's a loving family, which builds that kind of self-esteem. Under Mama's teaching and Bae's example, Susie's making most gratifying progress. Last week, she allowed a tooth to be pulled and was as steady and tranquil about it as any grown person could have been. Yet the forceps slipped off at 3 or 4 times before the doctor achieved success. Both of the children are sweet, gentle, humane, tractable, and lovable creatures with sharply marked and differing personalities. Susie's intellectual, deep thinker, is analytical, and a reasoner, is a philosopher, too. We've always looked upon Bae as a mere and dear little animal, but lately we're beginning to suspect that she has a mind and that she's deep and thinks out problems in privacy and keeps the results to herself. We shall see by and by. These children are selfish and high-tempered naturally by nature originally. But they have been so long and so diligently taught to keep these two gifts under the governance of a taut rein that now they don't show out very frequently. Susie has an admirable character. There's not a coarse fiber in her. She's as fine as gossamer and was born free of selfishness. A thing I was not glad of, for a little of it is not only valuable, but a necessary quality. You see how Sam's shaping his own values in this too, stating things about his own attitudes and morality and values. About selfishness. A little of it is not only valuable, but a necessary quality in every rightly constructed human creature. But Bae had a noble share and is divided up with her in the most generous way, so both are just about rightly equipped now. Susie has an unusually penetrating mind, a charitable spirit, a sterling and great heart. It's curious that there's a pang in it, too, to see so little a creature struggling to sound the great depths of thought in her brief plummet and groping around the mighty mysteries of life with her poor little farthing candle. Some sayings of hers, jotted down here and there in this book, are the outcome of these mere reveries and thinkings at times when long stillness on her part led us to supposing that she was absorbed with her dolls. "Papa, how will Brother Langdon know us in heaven if so long he's been there and he was such a little fellow? Mama, what's it all for? Life, labor, misery, death? Mama, do we walk ourselves or is it our bodies that are alive? Do our muscles act of their own volition, or is the impulse communicated to them by some higher authority in us?" After struggling with the fact that rain and sea are water, yet not the same, a deep mystery, "I find there are a great many things I don't understand." These remarks belong to the age of 2.5 up to 5. There were plenty more, but they're not recorded in past memory. A few days ago, she asked a few questions which showed that she discovered that life and death and suffering and toil and worry simply go on and on, forever repeating themselves, striking out nothing new or fresh, ending always in futile ashes and mystery, no perceptible result, at least no result worth all this trouble. And she had the long reverie over the matter and finally said, "Mama, what does the world go on for?" I wish I could recall some of Susie's speeches which illustrate her discriminating exactness in the matter of expressing herself upon difficult and elusive points. They've often been remarkable. Some of them were so good, the matter of discriminating between 5 shades of meaning, as any good person could turn out. Even Bayes, beginning to avoid looseness of statement and to lean toward an almost hypercritical exactness. Does this sound like an English teacher to you? The other day, she was about to start on an excursion among the calves and chickens in the back enclosure when her Aunt Sue, feeling compassion for her loneliness, proposed to go with her. Bay showed a gratification of so composed a nature that it was hard to tell it from indifference with the naked eye. So Aunt Sue added, "That is, would you be happier to have me go? Would you be happier?" Bay turned the thing over in her mind a couple of times to make sure, then said, "Well, I would be happy, but not happier." One couldn't ask to have a thing trimmed out any finer than that. Susie was sick all day upstairs, but was brought down to her mother's bedside this evening for a few minutes. Mama said, "I've missed you so. Have you missed me, Susie?" Susie remained silent and weighed the man with the conscientious desire to frame a reply which would convey the exact truth. This is the thing about lying again. No more, no less. When she got it thought out and knew she knew how the matter stood in her mind and feelings, then this modern young George Washington, who cannot lie, said, "Well, no. I had Aunt Sue and Rosa with me all the time, and they talked, and Papa read to me a good deal. No, I did not miss you, Mama." It was very sweetly and simply said. The manner of it could wound no one. Mama said afterward that the fact broke her heart a little at the moment, but at the same time, she respected and honored the child for her dauntless truthfulness. You see, that's something where parents have to basically put themselves down or let go or withdraw or basically help the child toward independence. And Libby was able to do that. Now, Mama shouldn't have any pang at all, for she knew Susie loved her to desperation and did not miss her for the mere reason that her mind had been kept occupied with the other things all the time. She's taught Susie to speak the absolute truth, unembroidered and ungilded, and Susie doesn't know how to tell any other kind of the truth. We often commend the children, of course, when they've been good, but never in such a way as to make them boastful. We never tell to other people the fine things they've said or done when they're within hearing, as less wise and extraordinary parents are so given to doing. He's kind of mocking himself there. And although they are beautiful, we are particular not to mention that fact in their presence. Mention was made of a certain young lady at breakfast, and Susie remarked that she was very pretty. Her mother said no, she had a good face, a face which answered to her exceptionally fine character, but she would hardly call it a pretty face. Susie said, "But Mama, I think that when a person has a good figure and a pleasant face that one likes to look at, then she is pretty." Reverend Thomas K. Beecher was present and said it was a nice distinction and that Susie's position was sound. Here's where it began now. September. Old Clark, the low-down, the intemperate, used to go by the farm last month, swearing. Susie's excuse for him to Miss Foote was, "He can't help it. He doesn't know any nice intellectual naughty words." From which the necessary inference is that she moves in circles which do. What have I learned? That Sam Clemens grew into fatherhood, that he was a sensible, sensitive father, that he was a lovingly observant father, that he was an appreciative, grateful, observant husband. We've learned that Libby and Sam, in the presence of death, built a supremely loving, nurturative, life-affirming family. We can take courage from that knowledge and rededication to the children. Twain still has some things to teach us. Thank you for your consideration. I certainly welcome some of your questions or comments or anything of that sort.
Where did this turn up? Where did you learn?
This is in the Virginia Library. It's in the... I don't even remember how I first learned of it now. I first learned of it about, probably more than 10 years ago. And my long-term sort of interest in this is to publish a book sometime in the next year, year and a half or so, that will be called Mark Twain on Children, that will be used as a fundraiser for the different Twain projects, I hope. And would have this material done in chronological order. That would mean the kids all mixed in together, but you could start in 1876 and end in 1885. And would have more material in it than Twain has published in the autobiography and a few other places. And would have many other things he's written about children and about children growing up, including a great letter that he wrote when Langdon was only 1 or 2 days old. And he wrote it from the point of view of Langdon to a great aunt. He says things like, yes, the great-grandmother, right here in Elmira, and it's complaining about their baby, they don't give me enough food, they've got me in a funny dress, all these other things. And a number of things that he wrote later in his life about positive and negative reinforcement and things about children, and to have blank pages at the end of it. Because I'd like to start, in my most grandiose self-delusion, another American tradition, the same way people take photographs of their kids, so that, say, 3 years from now, when somebody's having a shower or when a baby's 1 or 2 years old, people will buy the book and give it to the parents, and the parents will write down what their own children say. Because when people do that, I think that they become more sensitive parents, because they get inside the mind of the child. And that's a wonderful, puzzling place to be. And I think that that would be a positive step for this country.
Did you get the impression that he just dropped everything and wrote these lines down, or were there lapses in time?
Oh, there were certainly lapses in time. At one point, when they were moving from Paris to some other city, the journal got packed away. And then he couldn't work on it for about 2.5 months or so. But when he would work on it, some days it would be a three-line comment, some days it would be a page and a half. It's in sort of rough shape in terms of handwriting and things like this. It's one of those little notebooks that is modeled black and white, and you can see his hand impression on the back of it because he would hold it in his left hand, and so the back cover's worn away like for 4 fingers and a thumb, and the front cover's worn away for a thumb.
They never really did.
But there's no pages torn out.
He never really did anything.
Yes, he minded for writing the material for the North American Review, that was going to be his autobiography. So he minded, and then it says in the margin, used and not used. But most of the things that I've read today, except for some transitional things, were not used. And so I would say a high percentage of what I've read today has never been home.
Apparently, bad part about taking off your coat.
They fall out of the pocket. Some more questions, please. Do you think that this is a worthwhile project? Kind of sexifies Americans? One of your assignments will be to remember the things your own children or your siblings said, or grandchildren or uncles or nieces or whatever the people might be, and pass that around. Because I think that it helps people. Is one of my favorite topics. Listen eloquently. To listen with imagination. And when you listen like this, you put yourself inside that other person's head and heart and mind and everything. And I think you're a little better listener for it, a little better perceiver for it. Some more questions, please?
Well, this is a comment. I'm intrigued and impressed with the amount of time that he spent making up stories for the children, and we've certainly heard that before. And I don't know if you know, but there's an oral tradition here that you can sit in front of the forefront
fireplace.
And instead of the Aesop fables, we make up stories. And that's, you mentioned,
that's just totally consistent with this, because the tiles around the fireplace have different pictures, and that would give him sort of a narrative thing, and the kids could follow along. He didn't need MTV and so on and so forth to entertain the children.
We have a similar thing in art.
Definitely.
He went around the living room.
Yes.
Or the library, family room, and told whole story to him and everything that was in that room, every item in the room that had to use in the story.
That's right. Nothing could be omitted.
Nothing.
Plus, it had to be in the same sequence. So, in a way, the picture from Scribner's is kind of easier.
Well, when the children would catch up, when they didn't catch
that's right.
Omitting something, because that was the game. So, you try and skip something in the room.
That's right.
You would have to start back at the beginning of a different story.
Yeah. So, it was
last, week.
Right. You enjoy being inside the emotions of another person's family like that. And you see how important, how amazingly important, seemingly unimportant things are. The daily unremembered acts of kindness and of love that you stand there. Now, please.
It would seem to me that he rather liked telling these stories because all he had to do, if he didn't, was to stay up on the sixth floor and have a cigar there. But he deliberately came down right outside the nursery. Sort of inviting him to come out and putting himself in a position where
very available for him. Definitely.
Yeah. And that it's probably was good practice doing that. But certainly, and he came by very naturally.
Probably when he was a child by fireplaces or campfires, people in Missouri just tell stories. And that's part of a rich oral tradition. And you learn to discriminate between the fib, the exaggeration, the tall tale, the put on, the insult. All these things happen in this oral storytelling, or can happen in oral storytelling. Some more questions about this material? Would you feel honored if you were living by this journal? A lot of justice needs to be done, and I think Twain can work on that. Can you see increased, better treatment of children if this kind of material is widely shared?
No doubt about it.
That's something Sam...
Except for the flogging part.
Not that part. Well, you see, this is one of the difficulties of scholarship.
I know.
Because I have to be honest to the words that he said, and when he says flogging and whipping, I think it means that, never hitting on the face, as far as I know, always hitting on the bottom, never punishing in front of strangers or anything like that.
Well, you could always put it as a footnote on what he meant, you know.
That's right.
Now, how about the facts that we hear that his children, I mean, that it was a crushing blow to him that his children were scared to death?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, that was a horrible, horrible thing when we found that out. But, I mean, I don't get that feeling here at all.
I think it's been always hard in America for adult males to deal with their daughters, teenage years, and changing maturation process. I think that's a problem that's compounded by religion, compounded by so many things that happen in this society. And it's probably much, much harder now with television and nudity and different kinds of talk shows, what I call the making of America into a much cruder nation than it has been. When somebody who has something outrageous to say automatically gets on a talk show, whereas somebody who has something perceptive or sensitive or helpful to say, that's not interesting. That's not going to help the ratings. And I think the television is making us all have a much more fragmented consciousness with much shorter attention spans. I want to thank you for your long and careful attention and concentration. That's very good. And I want to thank the people here for Tracy, certainly for finding these photographs and displaying them. And I urge you to look at them. Please love them. Yes?
I just have one question.
Well,
pardon me.
I mean, I can do a few other potential to improve parenting, but I'm curious about the adults who would be, I don't know the specific name of the story, I don't know if you are a better grasp of this, but parents who really need better parenting, the better parenting skills, might not be the audience that would even know that this type of literature exists. Might, have you thought about developing any children's literature that would expose maybe some of this mission, some type of filtration to children? And then to your parents' school.
Through the parents' reading.
When the children are bringing home.
I haven't given, well, I've certainly given a lot of thought to what the marketing people call audience segmentation or something like that. And surely, because it's a book and because it's not a cartoon, it would be more accepted by literate people and by people who already know who Mark Twain is. That's a battle that is that I just have to accept as part of the given. I would hope that although individuals who are challenged in terms of literacy, but are certainly challenged in terms of time and economics. So I think that's a real part of America's problem nowadays. Would not be the first readers, but they might be the readers after it's been out 2 or 3 or 4 years, and when somebody gives them a present of a book which has blank pages at the back, which, by the way, publishers are very happy to publish. Any book that has blank pages in the back, they should want to listen to that. Then it may well be a gradual social change. And I'm working on it. More questions, please.
What you need to do is get hospitals to buy this and put it in the baby baskets for them.
That would be a terrific thing to do, especially because of the letter that I mentioned earlier, seeing things from Langdon's point of view. Because that's really when it has to start, I think. That's probably a very good way to do it. More questions, please. Yes, please.
Have you noticed that you mentioned dates earlier, technology, how that makes you interesting in the book? As you became a better parent, have you noticed that the voices of children in the literature
are more I think by the time he gets to Huckleberry Finn, and finally publishes Huckleberry Finn, basically he finished it at the end of the summer of 84, and there was proofreading and so on. I think that by that time, he was testing out a wise, perceptive teenager making moral judgments, sort of early teenager, about 13, 14-year-old making perceptive judgments. And I think that in a way, seeing his own kids grow, figuring out heredity and environment, and he already published some things about slum children. Huck is basically kind of a rural slum child. And doing things about positive and negative reinforcement. I think all those themes and issues show up in Huckleberry Finn, and certainly the voice. See, repeatedly, Huck does something good, and he gets a reward of some sort or another. $40 or a good meal or something like that. More questions? Please. I think probably not. I think that whole issue, my attitude is that if Sam were alive today, I very much doubt that he would spank or that Libby would spank. I think that they would have read Spock and Brazelton and any number of other people, and that they would do things like isolate or something of that sort. And I just very much doubt, well, first of all, I know that Libby would be a terrific parent nowadays, too. And actually, one of my qualms is that if the book would get into the wrong people's hands, they would say, well, Mark Twain's story. So I'll do what I have a ways to do, which would be, unfortunately, I have no way of stopping her. Any other questions, comments? Well, I invite you to go back to your own memories, and as you're talking with people, share and cherish some of the memories of the ways that the children perceive the world.
Thank you very much.